Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Everything changes, including The Office. You've probably seen it, lived it. Walls come down, cubicles went up. Now cubicles are often going away, even assigned desks going away. Working at the office can mean almost anything these days. What works for cost-cutting, for collaboration, for creativity? What works for workers? This hour on Point, the evolution of the office. You can join the conversation. What makes a good workspace these days? Have you gone from office to cubicle to free range? What works for you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we'll talk to two great office design gurus about the latest and greatest and gritty reality. But first, Rachel Emma Silverman joins us from Austin, Texas, management and workplace reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Her headline this week, Warming Up to the Office-Less Office. Her lead, The Boss May Be Coming for Your Desk. Rachel, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. What's going on when the boss is coming for your desk? What's that mean?
Well, in a number of offices across the country, managers are moving towards unassigned desks and unassigned workplaces. So in a typical office, people go to their own cube, their own desk, or even their own office. And yeah. Now, mainly as a cost-cutting measure, but there are other reasons for doing this, companies are actually creating free-range offices. So you go in the office every day, and you might be sitting one day next to Joe from IT, and the next day Anne from sales. It can be a free-for-all. And it's not like that in all offices. There are systems that companies have developed to have desk reservation systems and things like that.
How does it work? I see some photographs here. Here's one you've got with just a great, big, enormous table and people clustered around it. And what, today they may be there, tomorrow they may be somewhere else entirely?
Yep, that can be the case in some companies. So just a little background. Companies are doing this for a number of reasons. There are a lot of studies that show that in any given office, about half of the desks are unused at any given time.
Because why?
People are out for workplace travel, or they're working from home, or they're sick, or they're on vacation. So companies are finding that with all these fixed desks, they're basically wasting half of their space. So they're finding it's a lot more economical to basically have desks be used as needed.
So do workers wear, like, take backpacks? I mean, how do you carry, or they don't have paper anymore? You just show up at any computer, log on, and that's your place. But what about your stuff, or is that history?
So that, in some offices, that is history. So one company that's really taking this free-range office design very seriously is GlaxoSmithKline, which is actually based in Great Britain, but they have a lot of offices in the United States. And at their Research Triangle Park office in North Carolina, the company basically has transitioned more than 1,000 workers to this free-range setup, and workers literally carry their workplace with them in their backpacks, and they store minimal files in lockers and in rolling filing cabinets, and carry most of their intellectual property in their laptops, or, you know, their data stored in the cloud, and or in their mobile phones or an internet phone. So it's an incredibly mobile workforce.
This is a new step, and you're talking significant companies. I mean, GlaxoSmithKline, as you say, PricewaterhouseCoopers, American Express, and you quote a senior vice president at American Express overseeing this redesign for free-range office saying that, you know, you got a lot of people, that 50% unused sort of space that you talk about,
And then people have, she says, wasted drawer space holds stacks of old paperwork, cookware, shoes, personal items. And you quote her saying, those are just not things we want to pay for. We want to efficiently use that space.
Yeah, so companies are really kind of getting wise to these cost savings, and they're also pushing some other reasons for doing this. And you know, the jury's still out whether it's really effective or not for workers. But companies are saying that they're hoping that it will reduce email traffic because people kind of won't be siloed in their cubicles anymore, and they'll actually get up and talk to people in these more open plans. And GlaxoSmithKline actually did find that it reduced email traffic by as much as 50%. They're also hoping that it will lead to faster decision making because if people are kind of carrying all their information with them, they won't need to kind of refer to information later. Like it's much more instantaneous and much more mobile. So, and they're also hoping it will lead to kind of more spontaneous interactions with other people that they wouldn't necessarily interact with. So, you know, you might be sitting next to the IT department one day or another group another day, and so you might just meet new people.
Amazing. And less email because you're just going to have face-to-face conversations. You say this trend is really getting traction. Here's a survey of 950 companies. 60% have now some unassigned workspace in their offices for, I guess that's a kind of free-range approach, though some unassigned could mean almost anything.
Right.
What about, you talk about neighborhoods. If it's this free-range office that's adopted, neighborhoods like what?
So what companies have found is that when they have purely free range, so you're sitting next to a different person every day,
yeah,
they're finding that to be less effective because workers complain that, A, they couldn't find people because if you're using it in a new place every day.
Right. Where's Rachel? She was here yesterday.
Exactly. So that was very difficult. And secondly, that it actually weakened social ties. So companies were hoping that it would enhance social ties, you know, by meeting new people every day, but they actually found that it weakened social ties because people liked having neighbors. People liked having, you know, getting to know the person sitting next to them on a regular basis. That was very important to a lot of workers. So what companies are doing is that they're not necessarily assigning individual desks, but they're saying, if you work in IT, you're going to work in this area, and you can choose your own workspace on a daily basis within that area, but you're going to be sitting, you know, with other IT people. And IT works a lot with project management.
So you're
going to sit the project management people next to the IT people.
No permanent desk, just a screen and maybe a bag of stuff, maybe a storage locker. And then people are talking about in this free-range office, Rachel, you write about hoteling. What's hoteling in that environment?
Hoteling, I mean, it can mean a number of different things in different firms. It's kind of a buzzword, but kind of mainly it means being able to reserve a desk. So instead of just choosing your own desk daily, you can actually log into a kiosk or via your computer or even your phone and say, today I'm going to be working at, you know, this desk. And it's a desk reservation system, just like a hotel, you reserve a room.
And it's happening. I mean, American Express, you write about, they got a 51-story office building and three or four floors a year. They're shifting to unassigned, free range. They can save millions of dollars because people end up having less space, and the space that is there is used more, densely. Did you talk to workers in free-range environments about how they like it, Rachel?
Yeah, so I did. I talked to a number of workers, and to be honest, most were actually more positive than I had expected. I'm kind of a stuff person, and I like knowing where my files and my desk.
Yeah.
I think I'm just more of a traditional worker. But the workers I spoke to actually said that they liked it. They found it liberating to not be so bound to a lot of stuff. One researcher that I spoke to studied more than 1,000 workers at a large tech company that had done this, and she found that 3/4 of the workers she interviewed were fine with the transition to an unassigned seating arrangement, but about 1/4 really had trouble with it because they really found this lack of organization and this lack of personal distinctiveness, you know, not being able to decorate your space with pictures or bobblehead dolls, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They found that to be very jarring.
The free range office may be the next step in evolution, coming to an office near you or your own. Rachel Emma Silverman reported on it for The Wall Street Journal, joined us today from Austin, Texas. Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining me now from New York is Thomas Vecchione, partner and head of workplace design and strategy at the renowned international architecture and design firm Gensler. He's done high-profile, cutting-edge office design work all over the world, a big name in the field. Tom Vecchione, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Terrific. Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
What's the big trend? I mean, people may, you know, we've gone through a lot of changes in one working life, I guess. But to go from the old-fashioned sort of madman office to free-range office, people may be getting some motion sickness here, Tom.
Well, it's really interesting, I think, to see where workplace started and where it is today. And one of the biggest shifts is this new awareness of leadership around the importance of workplace, because work environments really represent the ultimate in social contract between employee and employer, mm-hmm. because employers are housing their employees. And it says a lot about how they consider you and the tools that they give you and the experience you have during the day. And it's a very important social contract. And if you think about the history, workplaces started in the 17th century out of coffee shops and private men's clubs and libraries.
Okay.
And workplace has always been intrinsically social. So it's great to see that the core of what it is being brought back as a social collaborative environment. So it's a great place we're in right now. And I think there are huge factors coming into play that are shifting us. Technology, of course, is one of them, and that allows us all to be mobile. The fact that I think we're all technology companies at heart, because we're all, mm-hmm. all companies, whether you're a law firm or a bank or anything, your technology core of your platform is technology. So that's kind of shaping the office today.
Mm-hmm.
And urbanization is shaping the office. We're 51% of the population now lives in cities, and we're comfortable with density. We're comfortable with a certain kind of lifestyle conditions where we go to different places to pick up things and do things. And I think that we're becoming a very urban culture as a whole, and that's translating itself into the work environments as well.
So, sounds almost like a fluid urban environment even inside the office. And you're seeing this as not devolution, but real progress here.
Yeah, I see it as a great turning point. And I've seen Incubator over the last 20 years of working with some terrific companies all over the world, mm-hmm. seeing lots of different things being tested. And what Rachel was saying, I totally agree with. It's not perfect right now, but we're testing a lot of different things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the evolution of the office and new understandings of good workspace. Just a couple of little glimpses of different kind of office space here from the AMC TV series Mad Men. Give us a look back at that traditional no disturbances allowed corner office. Here's a scene. Secretary on guard outside the office of Don Draper, played by John Hamm.
Miss Olson is here to see you.
Send her in.
Don Draper in the Fortress office in Mad Men, NBC's TV show The Office. You've got close quarters. Workplace means pranks very often for characters Jim and Dwight here. In the second season episode called The Fight, Dwight walks into the office and finds his desk is missing. He's left without a place to work.
Where is my desk?
That is weird.
This is not funny. This is totally unprofessional.
Okay, well, you're the one who lost the desk.
I didn't lose my desk.
Okay, calm down. Where was the last place you saw it?
Okay, who moved my desk?
I think you should retrace your steps.
Okay, I am going to tell Michael, and this entire office will be punished.
I think you should retrace your steps. Free range has become the thing, so maybe counting on a desk is passé. Maybe that's old-fashioned. Thomas Vecchione joins us this hour from Gensler, joins us from New York. He's partner and head of workplace design and strategy at Gensler. They do work all over the world. With us right now as well from WBEZ in Chicago is Sally Augustine, environmental psychologist, founder and principal at her consulting firm Design with Science. She writes about the psychological factors of design, person-centered design, for her newsletter and blog, Research Design Connections, and writes the Places That Work column for Metropolis. Sally, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
So we talked with the Wall Street Journal reporter who says, look, cost considerations plus new focus on collaboration are driving all kinds of changes here, including the free range office. I mean, where does this go, Sally? Where does this end?
Well, it's interesting that you started off talking about how everything is changing, because everything is changing except for who people are at the core and how their minds work. We still find work is really at the core of who we are. When we meet somebody for the first time, one of the first things we do is we ask, you know, what they do. And, you know, one of the reasons why unemployment is so difficult is because we don't have a job at the moment.
Okay.
And when we're working, where we're working is integral to that workplace identity. And I find that when people are talking about these new offices, they forget some things about basic human needs. For example, the kind of animals we are, we still feel more comfortable when we have a territory, which can be for an individual or a group. We feel more comfortable when we have privacy, when we need it. We feel better when we can restock our psychological batteries when they're worn down after doing knowledge work. And some of these new workplaces, forget about those basic needs that we have as people. And they also, you know, gloss over some things that we've learned in the course of analyzing how people work. For instance, a lot of valuable work is done alone. People, even when you're thinking about a group project, you find that people often, meet and then go to work on their own. You know, so working alone is an important part of collaboration. It's also an important part of any sort of creative effort. And I think that sometimes it gets lost when people are talking about new offices. And there's the individual and the way human minds work tends to be ignored.
Sally, stand by there in Chicago. You've put a lot on the table. So has Tom Vecchione. Tom, I mean, you describe a lot of what you do as anthropology, and Sally's looking at it in a kind of an anthropological way right there. So what about these needs? She's thinking about needs for territory and privacy and, a place to restock. At the same time, we've got the trend toward a much more fluid, collaborative, open office. How do these work together, Tom?
Well, you know, I think there's a really strong balance between them. And we like to look at work environments as accessible to lots of different distributed areas that people can go and do different kinds of work in. We did a study of 80,000 over the last few years, 80,000 workers and over 300 companies and 11 industries. And I agree with Sally. What came up was that the importance of amplifying the individual and giving them the tools that they need to focus. And I think 64% said they would rather be in a very small office than a larger cube. And that doesn't mean that we're going to go back to offices. It just means that there's an importance behind balancing what people do every day. And on a recent study I just came off of with a technology client, mm-hmm. when we analyzed work, we do a lot of analysis as well, because I think when you're designing a work environment, you have to be research-based, because mm-hmm. you're really looking at processes and you're really trying to understand behaviors, because it is intrinsically social and anthropological in nature, a workplace. And what we did was we found that out of the 8-hour day for, you know, an online salesperson, 2.5 hours was extremely focused with customers and online virtually, and they needed that intensiveness. And then 5 to 6 hours was preparing for those calls, going out to different places, reviewing decks, and we sort of understood that balance of what someone needed, the worker needed throughout the course of the day, and created the appropriate environments to accommodate that. So I think mobility and open plan is really important, but we need to balance what's the real nature of the work that individuals are doing, what's their work style, what's their work process, and creating environments that support that. And that's going to be very different for different companies, and it's going to be very different for different kinds of employees.
We've got all kinds of response here online, and let me share, if I may, some with you, Tom and Sally there in Chicago. Ann says, I'm not sure this will fly. Most of a job, quote unquote, seems to be more about the pleasure of imposing hierarchy on other primates as opposed to getting actual work done, much less creative work. Well, I don't know. Then John says, as long as you get your work done, who cares if you appear to be productive every second of the workday? Of course, appearance is important, because when you're free range or just an open plan, you're seen all the time. John writes, thought isn't visible. Turning coworkers into spies isn't good for a collaborative workplace. Surely that's not the point. But AC writes, it's mostly the old timers and slackers, like offices where doors can close or cubicles that enclose. It says, I prefer working in an open public space on projects. It makes for a more efficient and cohesive plan when everyone on the team works together, though there's always that person you wish would shut up. What do you hear in that range, Sally?
Well, first of all, I think it's very interesting that one of the messages talked about status, because that's sort of a dirty little word now everything, workplace design and other areas. But the kinds of animals we are and the kinds of animals we've evolved into do still think about status quite a bit. And there's an interesting case study. An open office was designed, and there were hat racks, coat racks, randomly spaced through the floor. And after a very short period of time, all of those hat racks turned out to be moved into the cubicles of the higher status people. So it's something we still do. I mean, we don't, you know, especially here in America, we don't want to ever indicate that somebody is of a different rank than another.
Well, I mean,
there.
We say that. We've got tall office buildings with honchos on top. I mean, Tom, in these open plan offices that are proliferating, are the bosses moving out into the open as well, or are they still in the corner office with the walls, maybe glass, but still the walls?
There's a mix. There's still a high majority of executives and leadership who need or want offices where they can have conferencing, where they can have confidential conversations around HR, where they can do business deals. So there's still a trend to have those. I just finished the headquarters for British Airways here in New York, mm-hmm. and you know they design their office on a free-range plan, and the leadership of the office wanted to be right out in the middle. They have a big farm table right in the center, and they sit right there by the coffee bar, and they want to see people coming in and out every day. So we're seeing a range, and I think what it's interesting about seeing a range is that people are really starting to voice their opinions, and companies are starting to understand that it's not the old man-men model of offices at the window and mm-hmm. admin on the inside, but there's so many variations on it today. And we need to prototype multiple ones to understand them better. And I definitely think there's a movement toward transparency, because transparency creates trust. So those glass boxes, if they are offices, at least they're glass and open, and at least people can see the activities or at least get a sense of connection to their leadership. I think people are really mobile today and commuting to very different places. So the fact that we all sit in open plan or transparent environments allows staff to be mentored impromptu, because I think mm-hmm. the rigor of always being in office every day is going away, because we're going back to Rachel's comment about offices are usually occupied about 40 or 50% of any given time. We need to see each other, be seen. We need a culture of see and be seen, because mm-hmm. We don't have the typical schedules that we used to have. So all of these things are sort of accumulating to come up with different strategies. And as I said before, I think there are growing trends, but there's not one direct fit for every single kind of office environment.
Let's bring our listeners in, if I may. Alan's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Alan, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention a type of office space that really works for me. It's just kind of new, is co-working, where people who are individual professionals who can work anywhere choose to work in a joint office space. I work out of Workforce Boston. And I find I'm much more productive when I go into work instead of working out of my basement. I just in the right mindset. And it also provides like water cooler chat and a connection to other coworkers who aren't necessarily working on the same project.
And what's the layout there, Alan? Do you have a desk, or you go to any screen that's available, or what kind of setup?
Well, you can choose. It's a business, and you can choose your own private office, or you can choose to have a dedicated desk, or you can choose to be free range. Free range is the cheapest, and that's what I've chosen. But it does seem like people kind of stake out their territory, even though I'm technically free range. I kind of have my certain spot that I get to, and people kind of gravitate around that same area. So you sort of have neighbors when they stake out their normal territory.
Sally says we're animals, and you can see that even in that sort of come-and-get-it-the-way-you-want-it sort of turf. Thanks, Alan. Jerry in New York, Plattsburgh, New York. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
Just a very quick thought is that I'm listening, and I enjoy your program when I get to listen to it.
Hmm.
But in today's comments, 98-99% of your experts are talking about the space and how much space a person needs, whether it be big, large, a cubicle, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I don't hear any comments about the productivity of the individuals that we're talking about. I just got in the middle of reading a book by Susan Cain, C-A-I-N,
mm-hmm.
called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And that also gives you a thought that, you know, some people need their own little areas where they can sit and work and talk to themselves.
Yeah, absolutely, Jerry. Let us go to that. And a lot of people are bringing up Susan Cain's book, Quiet. Thanks for your call, Jerry. Sally, let me come first to you. What about what we've seen about productivity as square feet per worker has gone down, as privacy has changed, cubicle, and then maybe sort of wide open? What about productivity?
When you're talking about productivity, you have to think about people who are doing sort of semi-structured work, and there's other people who are doing more unstructured work. People who are doing semi-structured work are people who like work in call centers, and there are things you can count in that situation. But with people doing unstructured work, sort of research and development type work, it's very difficult to find something to count. So when we're looking at productivity, we have to be more clever. And, you know, people do come up with ways to determine how workplaces are performing. And I think that if you were thinking about these new types of workspaces, you would get back to the comment that Tom made, which is things are in a testing phase, and we're learning about some things that work better than others. And I think it was very interesting that the last caller mentioned personality, because that is one of the things that environmental psychologists think about all the time.
Tom Vicchione, we'll come to personality. Let's first go again to productivity. Our caller asks about it. There's productivity, there's creativity. How do you measure the impact? Maybe cheaper. How do you measure the impact on work product, work?
I think that's a really important question. That's always been a dilemma because there are so many factors involved with what productivity is. But we're challenging ourselves to look at that. And I think some of the things that we look for is the criticality of the work that people are doing, how much of it they can do and where they're doing it, you know, sort of understanding that as a platform. And productivity is also employee engagement, and it's also number of sick days, and it's also the health and wellness of employees. There's lots of characteristics around what is a productive work environment. We are working with some clients in the pharmaceutical industry to understand what a healthy environment is. How can we start to limit the number of sick days through enhancing the air quality, through enhancing the light, through enhancing sort of the resources in a workplace to make people healthier? For instance, sitting in your chair 4 hours a day is almost – yesterday in the Wall Street Journal is almost equivalent to smoking, we hear.
Yeah.
So productivity is also about healthy employees as
but
well.
But when they're there, they're healthy in there, and we know that's an issue. But if it's, let's say, open plan, are people getting as much work done as when they had a cubicle? And a cubicle as much as an office? Or is there any relationship you see, Tom?
I'm sure there's a relationship of output in terms of the amount of work achievable. We did two headquarters in California recently for a technology company, and mm-hmm. one was a renovation and one was a brand new build. And we tried to measure productivity through the amount of time spent on campus. So we had these chips put in, and we tried to understand how many people were leaving campus versus how many people staying on between these two headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that the newly designed headquarters with more open plan, more resources, more distributed work areas, people tended to stay on campus more. There were more amenities. There were more resources. We felt that there was more of an appropriate work environment that matched their workflow. We found that there was less leaving the campus. So in terms of hours spent at the workplace seemed to increase through numerics be in a new work environment.
Of course, that's so, open plan plus amenities. I guess it's the whole picture that keeps people there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the evolution of The Office with Thomas Vecchione at Gensler in New York and Sally Augustine in Chicago. She's founder and principal at Design with Science. One more little bit from Mad Men on AMC. Here's that office moment where the copywriter Peggy Olson makes her move upward when she asks the boss, Roger Sterling, for someplace bigger and quieter to sit.
I need my own office. It's hard to do business and be credible when I'm sharing with a Xerox machine. Freddie Rumsen's office has been vacant for some time. I think I should have it.
It's yours.
Really?
It's yours, he says, and she's on her way. I need my own office. But that was then. Sadie in Brattleboro, Vermont. Sadie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I work in human services, and so we deal a lot with confidential information, mm-hmm. and we meet a lot with clients. And I'm wondering how you, if the experts have any ideas for how to work with those kind of issues in a more collaborative, open office environment.
Great question. Thank you, Sadie. Tom, I mean, I'm reading here, this is in the Wall Street Journal just today, about all these issues of noise and communication in the open plan, and people, you know, saying sometimes too much is shared, more than ought to be. Places even using what they call pink noise. They're streaming in a kind of continuous stream of noise over speaker systems that make it difficult to discern what somebody's saying, you know, the next table over. What about confidentiality and communication in an open office setting, Tom?
Yeah, well, those are imperatives that we have to deal with. Obviously, there's always going to be confidential issues. And when we work with the HR, human resources departments, we always plan for dedicated meeting rooms. If there is a push for an open plan and if there is a push to sort of rethink private offices, whether they become glass boxes or whether they become workstations or farm tables. But understanding the need for confidentiality is really important. What we've seen interesting in our studies is that smaller meeting rooms have 1- and 2-person interview rooms, mm-hmm. have a 73% utilization rate versus larger rooms, 5 to 6, which have a 60% utilization rate.
So you'll pop in there just for the moment that you need confidentiality.
More often than not, we're providing those. And we're also providing things like for consulting firms, small telephone rooms to have private conversations in. But these 2- and 3- and 4-person meeting rooms are becoming imperative to the daily life of a worker because more meetings are becoming WebEx and virtual. 1 in every 4 meetings has a virtual person connected to it. And these meetings are smaller and they're more team-based and they're on the fly. So these confidential, smaller rooms are really important to the lifeblood of a work environment today.
But you've got to have those. Bruce in Boston. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a funny anecdote. It dates back to the 80s. I was working in state government at the time, and my agency was abruptly moved to a new space. And so the space was not ready. It was a big, wide-open space. And so the office manager went around telling people, your spot is here, your spot is there.
Yeah.
And everybody started staking out their space with bookshelves and filing cabinets and piles of books on the floor. And there were arguments, you know, your pile of books is 2 inches into my space,
right.
Things like that.
Right.
And then when the office finally got built, of course, there were a certain number of people who had window offices who were a higher echelon. And then the interior wall of those window offices had windows, the panels had windows up on the top to let some of the daylight through to the interior space.
Yep.
But one of the panels didn't have the window, and the person in that office complained because she felt that that was a lower status thing that yeah. her panel didn't have the light, even though the light was for somebody else. The other point I just want to make is different people work different ways. I'm a piler. I organize things by piles, so yep. I need a space that, in addition to my desk, has a big table or something like that.
So what do you think about a free-range office where you've just got a storage locker somewhere and then go and find a place at a big old table somewhere, Bruce?
Well, that might work for me. I'd have to be a little more organized than I am, but that might work. But I agree with the comment about the smaller meeting rooms. I think several smaller meeting rooms make sense. I work mostly in nonprofits, and they all have boards of directors that are, 15, 20 people. So you have to have at least the one big meeting room that can accommodate that kind of meeting.
Where they can have that board meeting. Bruce, thanks for your call. Sally, here's a couple of comments online I want to put to you. And one goes back to the introvert question in an open plan office. Joyce says, you read my mind planning this show today. She says, as a proud and productive introvert, I'm concerned with the lack of regard for temperament in the new office designs. And then let me give you one more here from Victor, Sally. Victor says, thinking about an open office where everything's seen all the time and maybe judged, says, I don't want to be 100% productive or efficient in the workplace. If we ever reach the point where we must be, I will have arrived in hell, Victor writes. I hope I'm dead before they figure out how to make me accountable for every second I'm on the clock. What do you say to those two perspectives, Sally?
Well, first of all, I think Victor is safe. I think it's mathematically okay. impossible to be productive 100% of the time. Yeah. So I think he's not going to have to worry about that. But I really wanted to come back to the point about one size, one type of office doesn't fit all. You know, we've had a short opportunity to talk about the ways that whether you're extroverted or introverted mm-hmm. affects how you use the workplace. But there are other issues that are also important that sort of muddy the waters here. And one of them is national culture, which is getting to be more and more important as, you know, workforces, you know, mix.
What do you mean exactly? What do you mean by that?
Well, a national culture is the place where you were born and brought up. And that has a tremendous influence on how you live in the physical world for the rest of your life. For example, if you were raised in a country that values individuality, you expect to be alone more than a person raised in a collectivist culture. And perhaps even more difficult from a design perspective, mm-hmm. people who are raised in more individualistic cultures like the United States fiddle with stuff. Those of us who are from an individualistic culture mm-hmm. are always, you know, rearranging.
Making our own space one way or another.
Doing things like personalizing the tops of the desks, but
sure.
we also do things like see if we can pivot this wall out a little bit or something that, you know, can cause
that
like cataclysmic failure.
yeah.
Exactly. See? Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so research confirmed in action. Here we go. So, you know, there are a lot of factors that come into play. But there are some things that simplify this, keep it from getting out of control complicated. For example, people with similar personalities tend to end up doing the same sort of job ultimately. So, a thoughtful workplace designer can see that this group of people is primarily introverted and design with some more visual barriers than they might put in a place for people doing another job who tend to be more extroverted.
Right. Still, it's hard to know overall who you're going to have in that particular pod or in that company and how they're going to hit the space that you've arranged.
Well, there is research that can be used, mm-hmm. Indicates nurses tend to be this kind of personality, accountants tend to be another kind of personality type, etc. So you can get some information about groups of people overall, and that's mm-hmm. the level at which design happens because it's generally just not feasible to create a one-off workspace for a one particular individual.
Think about who's working for you there and what they are really like. Sally, stand by if you would. Joining us right
yes.
now from San Francisco is Ariel Schwartz. She's senior editor at Fast Company Magazine's blog Co.exist. She's been looking a lot at how companies are adopting a work-from-home model. Talk about getting out of the office. Ariel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So here we are. We're looking at different kind of office layouts, and you're really blowing right past the walls and to home. What does it mean when a big chunk of the workforce may not even be in an office at all or only there occasionally? What does that mean for office design, or for that matter, where do people end up working for home? Is it all off the kitchen table with the scrambled eggs on the side?
Well, first of all, I don't think at all that people are necessarily working from their houses when they say they're working from home. I know you had a caller earlier who spoke a little bit about how he enjoyed working at a co-working space,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's something that's becoming increasingly popular, especially in large cities where there are a lot of people who do work from home.
Mm-hmm. So working from home really means just work outside the office, and that may mean anything from home to Starbucks to you name it.
Yes. And I think that's, you know, it's becoming increasingly easier to work from places like coffee shops because they're starting to really welcome people who want to work there for long periods of time, you know, offering free Wi-Fi, having plentiful plugs. I know there's one coffee shop that I often go to that actually took out all of its plugs to discourage people from working there for long periods of time, realized it was taking away a lot of their customers, and then reinstalled them right back.
Are the folks working from way outside the office, are they doing Lone Ranger kind of jobs then, Ariel, or are they managing to collaborate even if they're not sharing a physical space at all?
I think it's actually very easy to collaborate at this point without being in a physical office. You know, I did a story recently on a company called Plantronics. They make wireless headsets, and they actually remade their entire office to accommodate people working from home. So in addition to having less desk space for people, they also have wall-mounted TV screens everywhere, you know, including in the cafeteria, so people can communicate with people outside the office.
Let me go to John in Nashville, Tennessee. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to speak to what the caller from Austin said earlier. I'm an entrepreneur, and this marketplace is being discussed for companies, but I think there's a huge marketplace out there for independent workers, and I've done some research and the business plan for it myself. The two things that I found mainly is that the collaboration and the privacy issue isn't really an issue at all. Entrepreneurs like to collaborate, and I think that innovation usually comes from that collaboration, and they prefer to be around other people because they're not in a traditional office. The other part is that the companies that have done this, two things, they price it out of market for entrepreneurs, so it's too expensive for the everyday worker, and two, it has to be in an existing place that already has something going on, like a Starbucks, so you can move the conversation from the meeting into another space, and that space can be a free-range space, and then you can also have private spaces that if you do need that privacy, you have it available to you. But I see it developing into something much larger than that, and that's just a way for people to meet up and collaborate in all sorts of different things outside of not only business but interests, whether it's politically, religiously. And I just think that if that model is grown, it can actually create an environment in which people can start to come together not only in business but in several other facets.
Take the walls down in all kinds of ways. John, thanks for your call. One more right here. Waynesboro, Virginia. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, I've had the interesting experience. I'm actually PhD psychologist, but work in the software development business, and we had a project a couple of years ago in which we had about 30 people working in an open office environment with about 7-foot tall walls, cubicles, and at my suggestion we replaced the cubes with much lower walls, actually 4 feet tall.
Okay.
And we consistently found increase in productivity and efficiency. And it seemed to be the case that in the old environment, people were actually very distracted, but they weren't aware that other people were being distracted by, for example, their conversations with their teenage son, or one person liked to whistle during the day.
But now you know, because you can see the eyeballs of the person watching you have that conversation.
That was exactly the case. And in our case, what we noticed was that you could, you know, on really productive days, you could hear the keyboards, you know, that was the predominant sound in the office.
If you had a big symphony of clacking, you maybe were on the productive track. Maybe so. It sounds like it worked for you right there, Tom. Tom Vecchione, is there an issue here that's emerging of competitive advantage one way or another when it comes to collaboration, innovation? I mean, is it possible to step all the way back and see, on the basis of who's got what kind of office layout, who's succeeding or otherwise, Tom?
Well, I think there's a direct correlation between successful companies and successful work environments. And I love the last caller, because I agree that high partition walls blind you in some ways, and you don't know how you're disturbing the neighbor next to you. So I think that's a great comment. I think that office environments that are designed around the employee's well-being, around the employee's social. I think offices are intrinsically social. It goes back to the model of the 17th century with coffee shops and clubs and libraries. I think that the more you're able to create a brand beacon for your company, the more you're able to create a center of influence and a center of gravity for your people, like any strong community, whether it's a religious community or a suburban community or, you know, just a personal interest community, it's about creating a center of gravity, and that has a larger implications. And successful work environments, they don't have to be expensive, they don't have to have all the bells and whistles, but they have to understand what is our center of gravity as a company, what's our cultural DNA, how do we engage our employees, how do we support them, and how do we get their message out there. And I think conversations like this don't have to be so technical. It's about employees understanding that contract and voicing their opinions too. That's why I like all these different opinions, because I think it's up to employees to say, you know, we really need and respect our work environment, and there are certain demands we have. So when we approach projects, we go and talk to everybody in an organization, because it's a bottom-up, top-down conversation.
Sally, our time is very short here, but do you think workers, by and large, with this change, are going to end up happier or not?
I think that ultimately workers will end up happier, because I see a general trend towards people designing for adding value and how individuals can add value. And people like to add value. So I think they will be happier as workplaces evolve.
And Ariel, last word goes to you. I don't know, does that center of gravity ultimately go wherever the workers are? Does the office itself become kind of a vestigial idea, Ariel?
I don't think the office itself will ever go away. I think there's always still a place for people to get together and actually see their coworkers in person. But I do think it will increasingly fade into the background.
The background as work happens all over. Ariel Schwartz at Fast Company Magazine's blog, Co.exist in San Francisco. Thanks a lot for joining us, Ariel.
Thank you, Tom.
Thomas Vecchione at Gensler in New York. Great to have you today, Tom. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Sally Augustine at Design with Science, joining us from WBEZ in Chicago. Sally, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Good luck to everybody in whatever your workspace may be. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.